From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! The U.S. admits the Sudan bombing is a mistake, but the U.S. press doesn't give it much attention. Is Tony Blair a war criminal? Britain's Prime Minister, Foreign Secretary, and Defense Secretary are accused of violating international humanitarian law. We'll speak with the international lawyer who's suing them. Also, a conversation with a survivor of a massacre in East Timor, as well as a man who worked for the Indonesian military and got documents showing the links between that military and the Timorese death squads. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Two American Apache crew members were killed during a training mission early today when their helicopter crashed in Albania, this according to the U.S. European Command. The deaths were the first confirmed NATO casualties in its bombing campaign against Yugoslavia. The crash came as President Clinton arrived in Brussels, Belgium, to confer with NATO officials about the six-week-old NATO air campaign. He was to fly to Germany later today to meet with American troops and some of the 675,000 ethnic Albanian refugees who've been forced out of Kosovo in the last month. NATO's top general acknowledged yesterday the airstrikes have failed to stem Slobodan Milosevic's campaign to rid Kosovo of its ethnic Albanian majority. General Klaus Naumann, a German four-star general and retiring head of NATO's military arm, said the air operation has slowed down the efforts of Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic's instruments for ethnic cleansing, but he said we cannot stop such a thing entirely. He went on to say Milosevic's mass deportation campaign appears achievable, adding while the Yugoslav leader cannot defeat NATO, he might be able to completely force ethnic Albanians out. NATO's military strategists have prepared a plan that, if implemented, would send 60,000 ground combat troops into Kosovo by late July, this according to the Wall Street Journal today. It said the plan is not for a combat invasion of Kosovo, where 40,000 Yugoslav troops are dug in, but an overview of how a semi-permissive entry by NATO would be executed once alliance bombing has shattered Belgrade's political will to continue the war. About a third of the proposed force would be Americans, again according to the Wall Street Journal. With violence sweeping East Timor, the foreign ministers of Indonesia and Portugal today plan to sign an historic accord that could lead to independence for the country. At issue is a wide-ranging plan for autonomy within Indonesia for the 800,000 people of East Timor, which Jakarta invaded in 1975. Should this be rejected in a UN-organized vote on August 8th by the Timorese, Indonesia has said it's willing to leave East Timor and grant it full independence. More on that story later in the show. Poor people in Latin America are growing in numbers despite economic development over the last two decades. This according to a report by the UN's Economic Commission for Latin America and the Caribbean. The Santiago-based agency estimated 204 million Latin Americans live below the poverty line in 1997. This compared to more than 200 million in 1990 and about 136 million in 1980. In New York, the trial of four officers accused of brutalizing a Haitian immigrant in Brooklyn opened yesterday, with prosecutors and defense lawyers offering graphic details of their versions of events in a case that has inflamed racial tension in New York and around the country. Jurors and spectators in a packed courtroom in Federal District Court in Brooklyn listened intently as the prosecutor, Kenneth Thompson, described what he called the cruel and simply inhumane attack in 1997 on Abner Louima, whose case prompted a series of angry marches and protests and led to a federal investigation into possible patterns of brutality in the New York City Police Department. Louima is black, and the four officers accused in the case are white. Louima, the prosecutor said, had been beaten in a police car by four officers, one of whom, Thompson said, later violently shoved a broken piece of a broomstick into Louima's rectum and then his mouth in a police station restroom, quote, literally tearing his insides apart. And this news from San Francisco. Manuel Pena Babbitt, a Vietnam veteran, was executed early yesterday at San Quentin Prison for the 1980 murder of a 78-year-old woman. Last Friday, California Governor Gray Davis, also a Vietnam veteran, denied Babbitt's bid for clemency despite pleas for mercy from thousands of veterans who believed Babbitt's experiences during two tours of duty in the war, particularly during the 77-day siege at Khe Sanh, were at least partly responsible for his crime. He was awarded a Purple Heart while on death row. Babbitt, who turned 50 just hours before he was killed, became the seventh person put to death by California since it resumed executions in 1992, and the second since California Governor Davis took office in January. He asked that the $50 allotted for the last meal, which he turned down, be donated to a homeless Vietnam veteran. Prison officials refused the request. A last-minute appeal to the Supreme Court for a stay delayed the execution by 28 minutes. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now. I'm Amy Goodman. In an admission that last year's missile attack on a factory in Sudan was a mistake, the U.S. has cleared the man who owned the plant of any links to terrorism. That is the opening paragraph of an article in the British newspaper The Independent. I didn't see much emphasis on this story here yesterday. The headline of that piece was U.S. Admits Sudan Bombing Mistake. The headline in the New York Times yesterday was U.S. Frees Assets of Suspect Embassy Terror Bombings. It conveys a very different feeling. Well, right now we are joined on the phone by Andrew Marshall, who is the Washington correspondent for The Independent. Welcome to Democracy Now, Andrew.
Thank you very much.
Well, can you tell us about this story? It seems that that bombing of the Sudanese pharmaceutical factory on the day that Monica Lewinsky was testifying before the grand jury in August of 1998 was a very fateful one.
Yes, it's an extraordinary story, and it was a particularly extraordinary thing for a gentleman called Saleh Idris, a Saudi banker who owns the pharmaceutical factory in Sudan, which the United States targeted that day. Mr. Idris was later accused by members of the administration of having links with terrorism, of having links in particular with Osama bin Laden, the man they blamed for the African embassy bombings. That was after the administration had already had to change its story once about the status of that factory. Now, Mr. Idris was not only extremely angry about this, but unlike a lot of people in that situation, he was ready and able to do something about it. He hired a law firm. He hired a firm of private investigators. He very skillfully made the case for his own defense, and his lawyers brought lawsuits against the government, which resulted eventually in the United States government deciding to unfreeze his account, though sadly that was not, is not, the end of the story.
Andrew Marshall of The Independent. Talk about the consulting firm that he hired, the PR firm, a very close connection, actually, to President Clinton, isn't it? Vernon Jordan's firm of Akin Gump?
That's right. Akin Gump, a firm which sits just a couple of blocks from my house in Washington, D.C., one of the most distinguished legal firms in the city, took up his case, partly because I believe there had been some links in the past, business links, between Akin Gump and Mr. Idris or people around him. I think partly also because the hope was that because of its excellent political connections, Akin Gump would be able to help Mr. Idris to press his case here. And I think to some degree that was justified. Akin Gump were in the end successful.
It's interesting the way things work in Washington. You do have to be very connected. Now, what about this contrast in the way it's being played? I mean, you put it straight out there. U.S. admits Sudan bombing mistake. The New York Times does not free this person, Mr. Idris, of any suspicion by saying U.S. frees assets of suspect in embassy terror bombings.
Well, it's interesting that one of the facets of this case since the beginning has been anonymous, unsourced comments by senior administration officials about Mr. Idris. After the United States government had decided to unfreeze the accounts, later the same day, these officials, speaking to the New York Times and the Washington Post, then said that, in fact, there were still concerns about Mr. Idris, that the reason they decided to back down was that they did not want to have to reveal their confidential information in court, which is an astonishing claim. If they are saying that they still believe that, this gentleman has links with terrorism, which I have no reason to believe, and indeed I believe is false, but at the same time they're backing away from that, that's a very odd situation. Again, it's extremely odd, or it seems extremely odd to me, that this claim, which is surely quite important, is repeatedly made on the basis of unsourced quotes. It comes from people who do not wish to identify themselves in the administration. It's a classic technique in Washington. It's a smear technique. It means that accusations can be made against somebody with absolutely no evidence whatsoever, something which if we were to do as private citizens, we would find ourselves in a great deal of trouble for.
It is a really astounding story, and you have to ask serious questions as the U.S. is currently in the midst of bombing of Yugoslavia about this, quote, mistaken bombing of the Sudan and the pharmaceutical company, especially in such a poor country as Sudan that is desperate for pharmaceuticals.
Well, that's right. I think all of us make mistakes. All of us accept that everybody makes mistakes at some point or another. Few of us, however, make the kind of mistakes that result in a salvo of cruise missiles being dropped onto a pharmaceutical factory. And indeed, if we did make mistakes of that scale, I think we would be held accountable for them. Now, my belief is that there is some form of congressional investigation underway into this incident. There may be other probes going on. There has been some discussion of whether or not the various congressional intelligence oversight bodies should be taking a closer look at this. And my hope is that ultimately somebody will be held accountable for this. I think it's extraordinary that somebody can make a quote-unquote mistake of this scale and not be identified and not have to discuss their behavior in public and indeed be able to continue to maintain the pretense through these anonymous leaks that they have made no mistake, but that they do not need to explain themselves any further.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Andrew Marshall, for joining us, Washington correspondent for the British newspaper, The Independent.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we continue on discussions today about bombings, this in Yugoslavia. Well, as NATO continues the bombing campaign against Yugoslavia and ponders sending ground troops, there's an organization in Britain that is suing the Prime Minister, Tony Blair. They've made a submission to the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, requesting the investigation and indictment of Prime Minister Blair, Foreign Secretary Robin Cook, Defense Secretary George Robertson for serious violations of international humanitarian law committed in the territory of the former Yugoslavia. The man who is a part of that suit, who is bringing that suit, is Glenn Rangwala from the Movement for the Advancement of International Criminal Law, known as MICAL. He teaches at Cambridge University. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Glenn Rangwala.
Hello. Thank you very much.
So can you tell us about this suit, about this submission to the International Criminal Tribunal?
Yes. Whilst we accept, of course, that Milosevic is committing human rights violations and forced expulsions from Kosovo on an enormous scale, the surest way, we believe, for those atrocities to continue to be committed is to commit similar atrocities on the Yugoslav people. So with that in mind, a group of us here in Cambridge University decided that we would resort to international criminal law to take the leaders of NATO to justice, to hold them accountable for some of the atrocities they have committed in Yugoslavia. And the way to do that is through an institution set up by the Security Council of the United Nations called the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. We've submitted evidence to them regarding two main issues. Firstly, there are the so-called mistakes, in a way similar to the incident you've just been talking about in Sudan, but unfortunately on a much greater scale. We've seen NATO bombs fall on civilian targets, apparently unintentionally. The point in those cases is that very little attention was paid to what exactly was being targeted. We see almost indiscriminate attacks upon sites in the former Yugoslavia, in Serbia and in Kosovo, the most notable of which was the bombing of a refugee convoy in which some 74 people died. In that particular incident, the NATO plane was flying at a height of 5,000 meters, which is higher than the tops of the cumulus clouds, higher than the highest mountain in Europe. And by NATO's own admission, the pilot could not see what he was firing at. Now, that to me speaks of indiscriminate attacks upon targets in Yugoslavia, the nature of which weren't even known. That is the first type of allegation we are making against NATO. The second type of allegation relates to the exact nature of the sites that are actually being targeted. 2 days ago, we saw the entire electricity supply to Yugoslavia cut off when NATO bombed five mainstream electricity power generating stations. We have seen attacks upon the infrastructure of Yugoslavia throughout the country, which has crippled the economy and the lives of the people there. And we have seen attacks upon civilian targets, such as the TV studio that was bombed in late April. A TV station was bombed in the middle of the night when it was known to NATO that civilians were working there, civilian journalists and maintenance staff at the TV station. Approximately 17 people were killed in that particular attack. Now, to attack a TV station is completely unlawful under the Geneva Conventions and under the statute of the International Criminal Tribunal.
In that case, we
have brought proceedings on the basis that a civilian target was attacked unlawfully, and that is actually a war crime. Mm.
Glenn Rangwala, that's very interesting, and it's an evening I remember well. It was April 22nd, and that's mm-hmm. when we were at the Overseas Press Club awards dinner, and it was actually Richard Holbrooke, the U.S. Special Envoy to the Balkans, who announced the bombing during the speech that he gave to this group of journalists. There were no boos that I heard. In fact, people laughed because he said he'd heard it from CNN and he believed everything CNN said. But it's interesting to point out is that they talk about propaganda being a tool of war, and that's why they bombed the station, that if they simply wanted the station not to be airing, they could bomb transmitters and not the place where civilians actually were working. Do you also understand that CNN, I had heard this story once, had been told to pull its people out? They were working in the same building so that they wouldn't be killed.
Yes, not just CNN. Most foreign correspondents filed their reports from that particular RTS studio, and all major foreign news stations were asked to withdraw their reporters from that station in the evening before the bombs fell. We've seen similar rhetoric from the British government, claiming that it was a tool, that the words of the Prime Minister, it was the brains behind the ethnic cleansing in Kosovo. That, firstly, is inaccurate. The vast majority, well, in fact, all the people killed were junior people working at the station, junior posts and maintenance staff. And secondly, as you say, they could have bombed any number of other sites without casualties. TV transmitters would be the obvious target. But even that would be unlawful. Under international law, to bomb journalist facilities is unlawful under any circumstances. And morally, I find it disgusting that they were willing to take such actions against human beings.
Finally, let me ask you, Glenn Rangwala, about other people that you have gone after in Britain. It's interesting in the place where Britain is allowing the extradition of Augusto Pinochet, the former dictator of Chile, perhaps, to Spain. What other leaders has your organization targeted?
Our organization aims to target any state leader or public official who is committing violations of international human rights law against people on a scale similar to this. So we have gone after in the past. We made a submission in the case of Augusto Pinochet, the case you just mentioned, and we also tried to take the former Prime Minister of Israel, Shimon Peres, to court, primarily for the Kana massacre, in which over 100 Lebanese civilians were killed. That was actually a crime against humanity that was committed in that case. And we believe that such people should firstly be excised from the political arena. They should be discredited and shown to be murderers. And secondly, if possible, they should be brought to trial.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Glenn Rungwala. If people want to get a hold of some of the documents that you are putting out, where can they go on the web, Glenn Rungwala, of the organization Movement for the Advancement of International Criminal Law, known as MICAL? Glenn?
Yes.
Where can they go on the web?
You could basically go to any search engine and just type in indictment, Blair, Cook, Robertson, and it will come up with the address. It's very easy to find. The documents that we've submitted to the International Criminal Court, the International Criminal Tribunal, are all on the World Wide Web, and you'll be able to see the sort of allegations we are making against the leaders.
Well, I thank you very much for being with us.
Thank
I'm
going
to attempt to give your website. So, folks, if you have a pen, write it down now. It doesn't have a www. It's http://ban, like ban the bomb, ban.jom.ac.uk/MAICL. That's Mary AICL. Glenn Rungwala with that organization, MICAL, speaking to us from Britain. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, an issue we've been hammering away at on Democracy Now!, press coverage of the war. We're going to be talking about the White House Correspondents' Dinner, the extravaganza that took place this weekend, and also the question of the Rambouillet text that was presented to Slobodan Milosevic by Richard Holbrooke, which he rejected, which ultimately led to the bombing. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, yesterday, the Senate tabled debate on the issue of war. Again, let's not forget, President Clinton doesn't use that term. Instead, it's air campaign and sorties, but we won't fall for that. U.S. senators, though, early in the week vented their frustration with President Clinton's handling of the Kosovo crisis, eventually shelving a measure allowing him to use all necessary force to end the war. We're joined right now in Washington, D.C. by Sam Husseini, who's with the Institute for Public Accuracy and has been following the press coverage of the war and the war itself very carefully. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Sam.
Good to be here.
Sam, before we go on to the, what did one newspaper call it, the Pressapalooza that took place this past weekend in Washington, D.C., the White House Correspondents' Dinner, to discuss the issue of press coverage, let's talk about this issue that you have been harping away at, that we also have been. It's why Jeremy Scahill, the co-producer of the documentary Drilling and Killing that we did on Nigeria, questioned Richard Holbrooke at the Overseas Press Club dinner, but was shushed by Tom Brokaw. Can you tell us why the issue that has been raised this past week, even amongst senators, is so important of the Rambouillet text?
This war started fundamentally because the administration said we went the last mile for peace. We sent Richard Holbrooke, we said, you have to sign this Rambouillet text that was not negotiated but talked about in Rambouillet, France in February. And if you don't sign it, we're going to bomb you. And he didn't sign it, and that was portrayed in the press and by a lot of people as going the last mile for peace. If you take a look at it, they went the last mile for war. This thing contains provisions that totally erode the sovereignty of Yugoslavia. They had conditions in there that no country could possibly agree to, particularly in Appendix B, We got excerpts of it on our webpage, accuracy.org, and we have links to the entire text on the State Department webpage so people can take a look at it for themselves. And I asked about this at a NATO press conference, got a very unsatisfactory answer from Mr. Jamie Shea. Jeremy asked about it, and Richard Holbrooke ducked. They almost invariably duck as saying, I was not at Rambouillet. This is the standard diplomatic response, cleansing their hands of it. The very premise of the Rambouillet so-called negotiations was an absurd one. It was sign or bomb. That itself, you had a legal expert before. Legal expert will tell you, that violates the Geneva Convention. You don't do that. You don't say sign or bomb. They came away from the Rambouillet meetings by saying that the Albanians had signed, but the Serbians didn't. What kind of negotiations is that? I've never heard of such a negotiation. When you have a negotiation, you try to bring the parties together by talking. It's my understanding that they didn't even talk to each other directly. The U.S. just said, boom, this is our text. Who's going to sign it? You're going to sign it. And then they basically told the Albanians, if you sign it and the Serbians don't, we'll bomb.
Mm-hmm. And
totally
as,
absurd premise.
And as you were saying in the issue, Appendix B, the issue of calling for a NATO occupation of Yugoslavia. I also got a chance to ask Richard Holbrooke, who brushed me off, saying I wasn't at Rambouillet, despite the fact that he was the one that delivered the text. And when Jeremy asked him about it, he said he didn't read Appendix B. But it was interesting to note that this is trickling into the mainstream, this issue of Appendix B that lays out a NATO occupation of all of Yugoslavia. Sam, you've been following the Senate debate.
Yes, and I was very pleasantly surprised to see that at least one senator in debating the McCain-Biden resolution brought this up. I don't know if I imagine that he might have gotten wind of it from either your work or my work, directly or indirectly, but he brought it up in a fairly proper manner. It was Senator Nichols, who's the majority whip. He's a Republican from Oklahoma, and I was very heartened by his remarks on Monday. I think we have a clip of it.
And again, when I read the resolution, it says to accomplish NATO objectives. We're going to use all necessary force and other means to accomplish United States and North Atlantic Treaty objectives with the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia. Well, I've got the Rambouillet Agreement. I wonder how many of our colleagues have read this thing. I would urge you to do it. I don't know if it's been put in the record. If it hasn't, I'm going to put it into the record. It's 44 pages. And I'm looking at some of the comments or some of the statements that are made in this Rambouillet Accord, and they said, well, we negotiated, and Mr. Milosevic wouldn't sign this accord. I'll just read one paragraph. And I brought this to the president's attention last week. And Secretary Albright said, well, Mr. Milosevic wouldn't even talk to us about an international peacekeeping force. Well, let me just read one paragraph of what we were insisting, that if he didn't sign, we're going to bomb him. And this is on page 41, and it's paragraph 8 of the Appendix B, paragraph 8. It says this, talking about NATO force. And some people say, well, let's give NATO all necessary forces. This is one of the things we said, we're going to bomb you if you don't sign. It says, NATO personnel shall enjoy, together with their vehicles, vessels, aircraft, and equipment, free and unrestricted passage and unimpeded access throughout the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, including associated airspace and territorial waters. This shall include, but not be limited to, the right of bivouac, maneuver, billet, and utilization of any areas or facilities as required for support, training, and operations. Basically, it says, NATO, you get to occupy not only Kosovo, but Serbia as well. Isn't that interesting? I brought that to the president's attention. I don't know if he knew that was in there. I kind of doubt it. And Secretary Albright almost acted taken back. Well, wait a minute. What are you doing reading Rambouillet Agreement? Well, this is what we were saying. He has to sign or else we're going to bomb you. Now, I think that's diplomacy failure. And it's led to a bombing campaign. Why are we going to bomb? Well, we threatened we were going to bomb, and now our credibility is at stake. I heard that time and time again. I want NATO to be credible.
That was Oklahoma Senator Don Nichols addressing the issue of sending ground troops in. But he was talking specifically about the Rambouillet text and this issue, I guess, Sam, of would any sovereign country accept a full NATO occupation of the country?
Yeah, I mean, that's the question. And I brought this to the attention of different legal and military people, and they varied in terms. Some are saying this is an outright occupation. Some are calling it a severe infringement on the sovereignty. But one person I brought it to the attention to, I was stunned, already knew about it. And that, for example, is Dan Garay from MSNBC. He's one of their main military analysts. And he was totally aware of this. And he denounced Rambouillet, and we put it on one of our press releases, that it was that it wasn't negotiations, it was a lynch mob, and so on. And he's very aware of it. And I've asked him, "Have you said this on the air on MSNBC?" And he said, "No, I've never been asked." So I mean, even when you have this plethora of military analysts on the media, that I think is a big problem. The one time where they could provide insightful information, they're not asked the relevant question.
Well, Sam, maybe we would get this comment from peace activists if they, too, were put on the payroll of places like CNN and CBS and NBC raising the issue of the Rambouillet text. And perhaps if the conditions were changed, Slobodan Milosevic would accept them. I had a chance to question Christian Amanpour at a pre-George Polk Award event. This was an event where she was beamed in from Belgrade by video, and journalists in the room got a chance to ask her a question. This was her response.
I'm Amy Goodman from Pacifica Radio, and I wanted to ask if you would criticize the policy of your network and the other networks in putting on the payroll military analysts. Certainly the Pentagon is more than willing to put out their point of view, and you cover it very extensively at the press briefings of the Pentagon as well as NATO. But why then also have these retired generals, a parade of them coming out and actually pay them? And if you are going to continue with that policy, what about putting peace activists on the payroll as well to give a different point of view? People, for example, like Noam Chomsky.
I suggest they offer their services to CNN and the other organizations. I suggest the more people that want to offer their differing views do. Look, you know, this is way above what I do. I have no control over what the organization does. They feel that it adds to their context. I agree with you. Perhaps we should have a range of different viewed people.
But do you think there's a
people with different views? I'm sorry, that was not even English.
Do you think there's a problem, though, with putting retired military generals on the payroll? Why pay them?
Do you include diplomats in that, too, retired
yes.
diplomats?
Yes. Let's expand it to all diplomats right. as well.
Look, you know, everybody, they're clearly there for what they are. I mean, it's not like we're hiding it. I agree with you. I think perhaps we should have different types of views on as well.
That was Christian Amanpour speaking from Yugoslavia to an auditorium filled with journalists. So I got a chance to ask that question that I've been asking all the reporters, like Frank says, no, why put military analysts on the payroll? First of all, when the Pentagon gives the opinion for free, and if you do, what about peace activists on the payroll? She said, you know, anyone can get on the payroll or you can ask to be on. So I recommend to people to call CNN and ask if you can get on the payroll too. But of course, it's not just an issue of on the payroll. It's simply being interviewed, being invited into the studio and being able to express your point of view. I thought it was interesting, Sam, that you're reduced to in getting out important issues like the Rambouillet text to leafleting journalists as they walk into the White House correspondents' dinner this past weekend. And I want to talk about that now. As bombs rained on Yugoslavia over the weekend, Washington's elite media was toasting its champagne glasses with the likes of Hustler magazine publisher Larry Flint, former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, the Clintons themselves, this at the White House Correspondents Association dinner. To many, the annual journalistic exercise in black tie excess has become an increasingly tabloid extravaganza. The New York Times described the event as a glittery scrum and an antic opera bouffe of media, celebrity, and politics, and did not buy the usual table, although some of its reporters did attend. Outside the Washington Hilton, demonstrators protest the war in Yugoslavia and held signs deriding the White House pimp corps. In fact, joining us in our Washington studio now at WPFW at Pacifica is Martin Thomas, joining Sam Husseini. Martin Thomas, a member of the Green Party and the D.C. Stop the War Now Coalition, one of the protesters in front of the Washington Hilton where the dinner took place. Welcome, Martin, and can you describe the scene outside the dinner?
Sure, thanks very much. We were out there. There were about five of us. These are great events to have, where you can have a small number of people and have a big input. And we had some street theater, and we're handing out leaflets. We had one of our protesters dressed up in a big Clinton puppet, a big caricature of Bill Clinton. And we were out there talking to media and getting a lot of attention, actually, due to our sort of creative techniques. And we felt we were being really successful in handing out flyers, specifically about what Sam talked about the Rambouillet Accords. And after about, we were out there maybe 45 minutes, two police officers told us we would have to leave. And they told us they were closing the sidewalk. So we initially refused to leave. Then when we did and crossed the street, we looked back and saw that not only was the sidewalk not closed, but many other people were allowed access to that area. So we clearly had been asked to leave just because of our views and just because we were effectively protesting the war. So then we tried to cross the street back to get back where we were, and the protester wearing the Clinton doll was arrested and charged with failure to obey an officer.
Now, explain the Clinton gimmick. What was the costume?
Well, it was a big kind of backpack doll with a big head of Clinton and big hands, and I would chase the doll up and down the sidewalk asking him embarrassing questions about why we're bombing and what his plans were to get us out of this mess. And he would give sort of standard Clinton-esque replies. And this was getting a lot of attention. And I think that's why we were politely asked to leave by the law enforcement.
But the person who was the Clinton puppet, he was arrested?
He was arrested. He was arrested when he tried to get access back to the area where we were protesting, where many other people were. We were asked to leave, apparently specifically because of our views. We weren't violating any laws.
This picture of a Clinton puppet, Sam Husseini, is pretty apt outside of the White House correspondents' dinner. Can you talk a little about this dinner and the history of it?
I don't know a great deal about the history of it, but it's a shindig where, you know, virtually every prominent Washington-based journalist is at. And, you know, I've been putting out press releases on the Rambouillet text as well as the 213 to 213 vote and trying to stir up some consternation about the lack of congressional authority for the bombing, but primarily the Rambouillet stuff, and have gotten very few bites. The only major newspaper that's run this is the Orange County Register, which is sort of a right-wing libertarian paper. And so I was, as you say, reduced to getting out there and finding a few folks who would be papering.
What's also very telling about this kind of dinner and what is so disturbing about it is you've got the people in power, just like at the Overseas Press Club dinner last week, where journalists weren't supposed to ask a key player in the war, Richard Holbrooke, questions because this was party time. As Leslie Stahl said, it wasn't the time or the place. But this whole issue of whether journalists should be cavorting with politicians, if, as I.F. Stone says, doesn't that compromise you immediately?
Yeah. I mean, it is a big schmoozing thing. And you had there were a bunch of right wingers there shouting White House pimp corps. We, you know, were at arm's length with that. But with some of their objections, I found a good deal of truth. And so, I mean, this was my opportunity to go up to Peter Jennings and say, you know, hey, can you take a look at this and assorted other notables to try to find some way of directly getting some information into their hands.
Bob Barr was outside as well, Sam Husseini?
Yeah, Bob Barr came after a while, after the arrest, I believe.
Yeah, he showed up after the arrest, and I approached him and asked him if he would like to put on the Clinton puppet and walk back across the street with us. He respectfully declined, but we thought that would have been a great chance for him, too.
It was our hypothesis that anybody who wore the puppet would get arrested, and I think an accurate one. I think anybody who wore that puppet and went back, because when journalists were coming in their limousines, some of them, you could see them sort of looking at it and smiling. And I think somebody from on high said, get that puppet out of there, because they don't want journalists seeing something like that. It detracts from the prestige of the president on such an occasion, I suppose.
Oh, yes, the prestige of this meeting. For example, as described in the New York Times, a guest of George Editor-in-Chief John Kennedy, Mr. Flint, sat in his trademark gold wheelchair wearing a satin Kelly green dinner jacket with embroidered lapels as the crowd politely stared. Susan McDougal eased herself into Flint's lap, whispered in his ear, stood up and announced, "It's so good to be outside," a reference to the end of her prison term. Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Sam Husseini of the Institute for Public Accuracy. On the web, it's www.accuracy.org. And also thank you to Martin Thomas, member of the Green Party in D.C. Stop the War Now Coalition, protesting outside the White House Correspondents' Dinner this past weekend. When we come back, a very serious issue. We're going to be looking at what's happening in East Timor today. An East Timorese man has just flown in to testify before Congress about a massacre that recently took place. Today, a Senate press conference will be held calling for an end to military, U.S. military funding of Indonesia. You're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we look at the latest that is happening right now in East Timor and at the United Nations, violence sweeping East Timor as Indonesian-trained death squads are going through the island. This is the foreign ministers of Indonesia and Portugal plan to sign a historic accord that could lead to East Timor's independence. This is an accord that would lead to an August 8th referendum in East Timor. The people would then be given the choice to vote for autonomy. It's expected that they would reject that vote for autonomy. And if they do reject it, Indonesia will then grant East Timor independence. The question is, what will be the circumstances of that vote? Will the Indonesian military be running the show as they have for 23 years, where they've killed more than a third of the population? Well, right now, we're joined by people who are eyewitnesses, who are survivors in East Timor. They've just flown in yesterday from East Timor. They've had a long trip. We're joined right now by Francisco Jesus da Costa, who is a man who survived the Lekisa massacre several weeks ago. He will describe that and just who perpetrated that. And he is translated by, we'll say, Aryati. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Francisco.
Ya, selamat pagi.
He, by the way, is speaking Indonesian.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning. Can you describe what happened in Lekisa, which is a city outside of Dili, the capital of East Timor, and the date?
Bisakah kamu ceritakan apa yang terjadi di Lekisa pada tanggal 6 April itu, pada pembantaian?
As she translates and he responds, I'll just say that the people of East Timor must speak. He can he can talk Indonesian since the Indonesian
Milisi,
invasion and occupation.
Dengan ABRI bergabung untuk menyerang.
Militia and the military join forces to attack.
Menyerang masyarakat.
Civilians.
Masyarakat yang berkumpul di rumah pastoran.
Gathered
cara membayu buta.
Inside of the parish of Lekisa.
Mereka membunuh masyarakat sipil yang tidak tahu apa-apa, yang berlindung menyelamatkan diri di rumah pastoran.
They killed all the civilians inside of the priest's house who and the civilians don't know anything.
Jumlahnya di atas 200 lebih.
The number of those who died, according to me, is 200 people.
Pada waktu itu mereka juga menyiram gas air mata,
throw tear gas against the innocent civilians.
Dan api terus menembak masyarakat yang tidak bisa masuk ke ruangan pastor.
And the military kept shooting at the civilians who tried to get into the Paris house, but they couldn't get in because the house was jammed.
Mayat-mayat itu sampai sekarang belum dikembalikan kepada keluarganya dan tidak tahu dibuang ke mana.
Many of the dead bodies were missing, disappeared, and the military didn't return the dead bodies to their families for proper burial.
Jadi saya juga salah satu korban yang lolos pada waktu itu.
Dan I was one of the victims who escaped death.
Diri,
and to save myself,
dan saya berobat ke Dili dan langsung ke sini.
I had to leave for Dili and then left for the United States.
Jadi saya mengharapkan semoga masyarakat Amerika Serikat.
So I hope that people of the U.S.
untuk betul-betul menangani kasus ini, karena ini terjadi di rumah.
To pressure the Indonesian government to handle this case because this massacre happened in the house of the priest.
Dan kami sangat mengharapkan kehadiran pasukan perdamaian dari PBB untuk turun ke
Timur. And I expect that the UN peacekeeping troops will be sent to Indonesia immediately.
Terutama selama pemungutan suara
during the ballot which will happen on August 8th.
Yang paling terpenting adalah pasukan
the
kami
most important thing
kembali, atau kami harapkan pasukan menetap di sana selama
that the UN peacekeeping troops can stay in Delhi or in East Timor during the ballot.
Setelah pemungutan suara selesai,
after the ballot is finished,
dan masalah ini sudah ditangani
and
oleh
the
Indonesia,
problem
oleh
is resolved by the UN,
maka ini pasukan Indonesia, pasukan keamanan harus menetap di
sana. So the UN peacekeeping troops still have to remain there so that the ballot can go on peacefully.
Karena selama mereka pasukan keamanan tidak ada di sana, mereka membuat seenaknya, membunuh dan meneror pasukan yang tidak tahu apa-apa.
Without the presence of the UN peacekeeping troops, the Indonesian military just killed off people like their animals.
Sesuai dengan apa yang terlihat sekarang, mereka memaksa masyarakat untuk mendukung otonomi.
Just like what happened recently, they forced civilians to support autonomy.
Jadi sekali lagi yang paling terpenting,
so once more, the most important thing is that the presence of the UN peacekeeping troops so that the ballot can be held successfully and peacefully.
Tidak perlu jumlah personil yang ada di sana di atas 500 lebih.
If it's necessary, there should be more than 500 people there.
Atau tergantung TPS yang ada.
Or it depends also in the number of the ballot booths there.
I want to just let me intervene for a minute and let people know who are just tuning in. You're listening to Francisco Jesus da Costa, who is a Timorese who survived the Lekisa massacre several weeks ago in East Timor, where he says up to 200 people were killed. He was in the priest's house. And I want to clarify this. Who is it that did the killing?
Siapa yang melakukan pembunuhan di Lekisa pada tanggal 6 April?
Milisi didukung oleh ABRI.
The militia supported by the Indonesian military.
Now, let's talk about these militias. I also want to refer people today to the New York Times, the op-ed page, East Timor's Bloodiest Tradition. There is an unusual op-ed piece. It is by an East Timorese named Aniceto Gutierrez Lopez, and it talks extensively about these militia. We're also joined in the studio by Manuel Dos Martires, who worked for the Indonesian military and was able to smuggle out some documents. Can you tell us, Manuel, what the documents showed about the relationship between the Indonesian military that has been armed and financed for a long time by the U.S. and these death squads in East Timor?
Bisakah kamu ceritakan sedikit hubungan antara militer Indonesia dan para militer berdasarkan pengalamanmu
bekerja di
kantor Korem? Jadi khusus hubungan antara militer dan paramiliter.
Oke. Di sini saya dapat ceritakan bahwa
I can tell you now that
bahwa selama ini yang dibicarakan oleh ABRI, pemerintah Indonesia,
the military always said that
Menteri Luar Negeri Ali Alatas Indonesia
and also the minister, the foreign minister of Indonesia always
mengatakan
said
bahwa di Timur-Timur
in East Timor,
hanya sebanyak 6,000.
There are only 6,000 soldiers there.
Sedangkan dan Rem, Korem 164 Wiradharma, Tonoh Seratman,
well, according to the document that I have,
mengatakan bahwa ABRI yang ada di Timur-Timur
it shows
adalah
that
hanya
the number
10,000 orang.
Of troops in East Timor is more than 10,000 people.
Sedangkan yang saya dapat di komputer dan saya sebagai seorang operator komputer di staf personil Korem 164 Wiradharma,
since I work as a computer operator at the East Timor military office, I can acquire information about the number of troops in East Timor.
Yaitu sebesar 21,658 orang personil.
The number is 21,658 people.
Itu hanyalah pasukan resmi yang didaftar. Sedangkan ada juga pasukan yang tidak resmi atau pasukan luar.
These are only what is called official troops. While outside of these official troops, there are wild troops.
Yang di sana pasukan liar atau pasukan tidak resmi, jumlahnya sekitar 11,000 orang.
Or wild troops, the number is 11,000 people.
Jadi kalau ditambah pasukan liar dan pasukan yang resmi sekitar 32,000-an lebih.
Of the total number of troops, the official and wild troops in East Timor right now is about 32,000 people.
Saya dapat ini yang pertama saya jawab, saya bisa jawab. Mungkin ada pertanyaan berikut, saya tunggu.
That's all I can answer right now. If there's another question, I'll answer that.
Well, I just want to let our listeners know it's interesting to note that in the op-ed piece by the Timorese lawyer of the group HAWK, which is a well-known legal aid human rights and justice foundation in Indonesia, he also says in this op-ed piece that the year-old Habibie government, that's the regime in Indonesia now, has allowed the army to arm and finance the Timorese militia to create the appearance of a civil war. The government has frequently denied such charges. He says that Portugal and the United States should insist on a disarming of the militias and a substantial withdrawal of the army, and that if this does not happen, he says, Washington should see Indonesia gets no military aid and training until a valid vote on independence is held. Just a brief comment. Last week on Friday on Democracy Now!, we had a guest on the show, Father Michael Lapsley, who was blown up by a letter bomb. Not before Nelson Mandela was released from prison, but after he was released, and that these often are the key times in liberation struggles, at the time of negotiation, when those in power see that they are losing their power. This is the period where the worst violence can take place and so many people die. I'm concerned that in these last few months, as Indonesia has announced that they will grant East Timor independence, people look away when at this point, more than ever, there is tremendous concern and violence in East Timor with these, for the first time, Indonesian-armed Timorese militias. Now, I wanted to go back to Francisco Jesus da Costa, who survived the massacre in Lekisa, and ask about the effect that this has had on the civilian population in Timor, this kind of killing of up to 200 people. What does it do to your family and friends who have survived?
Apa akibat dari pembantaian yang terjadi yang dilakukan oleh para militer terhadap keluargamu, kawan-kawanmu, dan masyarakat Timur-Timur yang lain? Gimana bisa kamu ceritakan sedikit?
Yang jelasnya keluarga saya tidak tahu saat ini dalam keadaan.
I don't know what happened to my family right
semua
now.
Semua teman-teman saya lari ke hutan.
Many of my friends fled to the jungle and many more disappeared.
Karena lebih berat lagi masalahnya yang mereka bunuh itu masyarakat sipil.
The more important problem actually is that most of the people who got killed are innocent, unarmed civilians.
Hanya menyapu halaman sekolah dan jalan-jalan raya.
Whose work every day is just sweeping the streets or just go work in elementary school.
Mereka sebenarnya tidak berpartisipasi dalam politik.
They never participated in politics.
Mendukung
and they were killed because they were allegedly supported East Timor's independence.
Saya sangat menyesal karena yang
I really regretted it because
abri dari Timur Timur yang dibayar oleh
who killed these civilians were East Timorese who joined the militia or the Indonesian military, and sometimes they got paid to do the dirty work.
Dan yang lebih mengecewakan lagi,
what is more disappointing is that Indonesian government
atau membiuskan mereka
also give drugs
orang-orang yang tidak tahu apa-apa
to the East Timorese militia in order to be able to kill their own fellow countrymen.
Kejadian di Likisa juga mereka
incident
menghancurkan patung-patung
in
suci.
They also destroyed the statues, the Catholic statues inside of the priest house.
Patung itu sangat berharga dan paling
this,
penting dalam hidupnya.
For us who are Catholic, it is very disgraceful
padahal
that East Timorees would do such a thing.
Menyatakan bahwa harus menghargai dan menghormati agama yang lain.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us as you begin this tour to let the United States know what's happening. We're also joined in the studio by Lynn Fredrickson, who is with the East Timor Action Network, who is escorting you around. Yesterday, the people who are listeners who've just heard, both Francisco Jesus da Costa, who survived the massacre, and Manuel dos Martires, who worked for the Indonesian military, testified before Congress. And there is a lot happening in Congress and at the UN right now. We only have 2 minutes, but Lynn Fredrickson, I was wondering if you could lay out for us what's happening at the news conference today in Washington and also up at the United Nations.
Good morning, Amy. I'd be pleased to. This afternoon at the Senate, Senators Russ Feingold and Patrick Leahy will be joined by our eyewitnesses that you've been interviewing today to introduce two new pieces of legislation that will basically say that until the Indonesian government disarms the paramilitaries and allows free access to East Timor, the U.S. government should be providing no further military assistance to Indonesia. In addition to that, there will be a House subcommittee hearing in the Human Rights Subcommittee on Friday afternoon. And in light of that, I want to mention that another important piece of legislation already introduced with over 60 co-sponsors in the House, including Representative Chris Smith, is a bill that would close the loophole that allowed training like JSET to continue last year.
And that training allowed the Kopassus troops, the elite troops of the Indonesian regime, to be trained by Green Berets of this country?
It did. It allowed direct combat training despite congressional intent after a ban on the IMET training program in 1992 after the Santa Cruz massacre.
And in the brief seconds we have left, like 30, can you explain the significance of what's happening at the United Nations today, Lynn?
Today is a big day at the United Nations for East Timor. Indonesia and Portugal will come together, their delegates, and there should be a signing of an agreement. That agreement will decide the final terms of an autonomy plan that will then be presented to the East Timorese people. It is highly assumed that under a free and fair ballot, that autonomy plan would be rejected by the people of East Timor who have been living under the brutal occupation of Indonesia for 23 years. But the terms are very important, and especially important regarding the security arrangements, which mean how many UN forces, what type of UN personnel, the numbers of others allowed into East Timor, including international monitors, human rights groups, humanitarian and relief efforts, will be allowed into East Timor and in the coming months leading up to the August 8th potential ballot.
And Lynn will certainly continue to cover it. I want to thank you as well as our other guests for joining us today. Again, if you want to get information about the East Timor Action Network, you can call 914-428-7299. And if you'd like to cassette copy of today's show, 1-800-735-0230. News conferences today at the UN and at the Dirksen Building at 2:30 today in Washington. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Yeah.
on the